Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, October 27th, 2015. Is Obama engaging in his grand bargain that would hurt Social Security and Medicare? Oh, come on, Barack.
Don't do me like that. Don't do me like that. Well, I love you, baby. Don't
a couple of times during the Obama presidency, there have been back-channel talks between the White House and Republican leaders where the president has offered up cuts to Social Security and Medicare. And he's at it again. Now, it's complicated because the president, the White House, the Democratic leaders on the Hill have been quietly working with Republican leaders despite all of the drama of John Boehner quitting and the speakership battle, the disarray of the Republican presidential race. And so, in many respects, it's a good thing that they appear to have brokered a deal for a 2-year budget. This is almost unheard of in the obstruct Obama era. And the package covers a lot of contentious items, including raising the debt ceiling, dealing with pesky issues like the Export-Import Bank, and other matters as well. But when you read the fine print, the agreement would raise spending by $80 billion over 2 years. It basically has a 2-year exemption to the spending caps that were imposed under sequestration. It includes a big increase in defense spending that I'm not happy about. And those increases would be offset by cuts in spending on Medicare and Social Security disability benefits, as well as savings or revenues from an array of other programs that aren't named, including selling oil from the nation's strategic petroleum reserves. Now, hear me out. Which is more idiotic? To sell oil when the crude price benchmark worldwide is at an all-time low? Why would we do that? What is the point? We put oil into the strategic reserves at $50, $75 a barrel, and we're going to sell it for $25 or $30 to raise cash for this budget deal? Now, I think it's even more ludicrous to pretend that cuts to Medicare and Social Security, which are in separate budgets, they're not a part of the spending plan that either, you know, puts more money in the Pentagon or doesn't. They are separate. And so this is simply a sop. It is pandering to the hard right, saying we've got to see some cuts in entitlements so that we can go back to our ugly base and tell them that we hurt poor people again. Now, the other thing that is idiotic, as you know, is that the Social Security Trust Fund, which includes a number of sub-funds like the Disability Fund, has been borrowed against by the Congress in brutal ways for decades. And so when people claim that Social Security and Medicare are going to run out of money, if Congress repaid the loans that it had taken from these funds, those dates would be pushed further out into the future. And if Congress would make reasonable increases in the FICA cap, the amount of money that is taxable to Social Security, which is now capped at about $120,000 in income a year, the Social Security Fund would be solvent for all of the foreseeable future. Likewise, if Bernie Sanders' proposal for Medicare for All is embraced, well, we would see Medicare shored up. We would see the pool of people who draw on Medicare be younger and healthier and spread the risk even further, which lowers the costs and reduces the rate of increase in health care expenses. It's all extremely logical, but it doesn't fit with the corporate pro-rich agenda of the Republicans who control the Congress. Now, I recognize that Obama has limited options here in order to get a package like this through. And there's a tax apparently on hedge funds and private equity firms that evens out some of the benefits that they've been getting away with. But it is unconscionable to make these cuts. And when you read the fine print, it says the Social Security Disability Insurance Program will be amended to tighten and standardize eligibility requirements that now vary by state. It would save a paltry $5 billion. But you know what that language means? People are going to be denied coverage under Social Security disability. Now, nobody considers disability to be a free ride, some gift from the government. In order to qualify, you got to be disabled. And the amount of money is so paltry that this is just, it's immoral. It really is. To increase defense spending while you save $5 billion by cutting some unknown number of people off of Social Security disability? Well, I was tipped off when Bernie Sanders appeared last night on Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC. And while Sanders didn't go postal about it, he flatly said he's not for it. I'd like to see a little more rise out of the candidate on this issue that cuts right to the heart of the talking points that he's using for his campaign. Well, there's a possible international diplomatic and military crisis looming, and the U.S. has provoked it with China. China has summoned the American ambassador after Washington launched a direct military challenge to Beijing's territorial claims in the South China Sea. We sent naval warships on maneuvers near these two concocted islands. They've been created with landfill on disputed reefs. They're called the Spratly Mischief and Subi Reefs. And we sent the guided missile destroyer, the USS Lassen, to just cruise by. And to make sure to get closer than 12 miles, which is the international waters limit claimed by China. Now, I do understand the issue here and that China's claim is fatuous. It's not credible. But why does the U.S. feel the need? Apparently Obama took this up with Xi Jinping when he was in Washington a few weeks ago. They had a candid discussion. And apparently the Pentagon has been pushing for this provocation for a long time. The Chinese embassy said the concept of freedom of navigation should not be used as an excuse for muscle flexing, and the U.S. should refrain from saying or doing anything provocative. And they quote in this article in the Guardian newspaper, Ian Story, a South China Sea expert in Singapore. He said, Washington has gone in heavy. There's not much else heavier than that, referring to the Lassen, except an aircraft carrier. They want to send a very clear message to China that they're serious about this. And China will have to react. It cannot not react to this. So we'll see how it plays out. Satellite photographs have shown the construction of three military-length airstrips by China in the Spratlys, including one each on the aptly named Mischief Reef and the nearby Subi Reef. Speaking of China, one of its dissidents is a talented artist and a man who has suffered a great deal for his personal expression and for his family lineage. His name is Ai Weiwei. Last name is spelled W-E-I-W-E-I. And I've talked about Ai Weiwei before because I was so struck by an art exhibit that he put on remotely from China on the island of Alcatraz, the prison island here in the middle of San Francisco Bay. And right behind my microphone here, I keep a little postcard with a beautiful rendering of a rose that was painted by Ai Weiwei. And it was part of an exhibit, a tapestry made of Legos. And the tapestry depicted some 175 political prisoners around the world. It included Ed Snowden, John Kiriakou. And I talked to Kiriakou about this. If you've heard our interview, you know that he was deeply touched when he received more than 1,500 of these Ai Weiwei postcards from visitors to the Alcatraz art exhibit. Now, the tapestry of political prisoners was made entirely on Legos. That's right, the little plastic building blocks that kids play with. And I'm pro-Lego. My stepson David grew up on Legos, and I think it taught him spatial skills that really enhance his work as an electrical engineer today. But now Lego has said that Ai Weiwei can no longer use Lego bricks to create art exhibits with a political message. And they are politely declining to sell him blank Legos that he could create art on. This is for an upcoming exhibit in Melbourne, Australia. And it's created quite a flap, and Australians have been offering to cough up their own personal supplies of Legos for him to work with. And this column at The Guardian is touching because the columnist, whose name is Van Badham, points out that Ai Weiwei's father was a poet exiled to the Gobi Desert during the Chinese Cultural Revolution. At one point, they had to live in a hole in the ground, and that's when Ai Weiwei learned how to make his own bricks in that hole in the ground. And as an adult artist, he gained notice and notoriety for criticizing the Chinese government. He was the renowned designer of Beijing's Bird's Nest Stadium. But then he was punished. The government shut down his blog. He was beaten to the point of cerebral hemorrhage when his Shanghai studio was demolished for lacking a planning permit. In 2011, he was imprisoned for 81 days. And then this summer, they gave him back his passport, and he relocated to Berlin. And he is trying to put on this exhibit in Melbourne, Australia. And there is a suggestion that Lego is afraid of angering the Chinese government and limiting its ability to sell building block toys in China. That's pretty sad. By today, the 27th of October, Shakir Amer should be home in London with his family. It was announced on September 25th that 30 days after that date, that he would be released from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The 30 days required notification to Congress. And on Saturday, Andy Worthington and other supporters of Shakir Amer went to No. 10 Downing Street in London and demanded that Prime Minister Cameron take action to bring Shakir Amer home pronto. I'll be watching carefully and let you know when the news breaks. And I hope the United States will not renege on its agreement to release him. Also at Guantanamo, a good story from Al Jazeera today regarding the efforts by Ramzi bin al-Shib and Walid bin Attash, who are co-defendants with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in the tribunal that is just grinding along at the slowest possible pace. And bin Attash has recently asked to represent himself because he can't trust his defense team because it could be compromised by the CIA. And bin Attash is the guy who previously, bin al-Shib, I'm getting my defendants mixed up here, but bin al-Shib is the one who wants to represent himself, and he once saw a courtroom interpreter at Guantanamo who he had also seen while he was being tortured at a CIA black site. And there are many other problems. Microphones have been discovered in rooms used by defense lawyers. Their emails have been tampered with. People have been inserted on the defense teams with connections to the FBI or the CIA. And, of course, then there is the problem of secrecy. The government claims that the defendants are not permitted to see the evidence that is used against them. And so how can a defendant represent himself if he's not permitted to see the charges and the evidence being used to try him? I mean, even if you're not representing yourself, that's a glaring violation of fundamental rights. And the other issue is the torture. Because the U.S. pretends that you can't enter evidence of torture, you can't talk about torture. And so, ultimately, these trials have no possibility of being conducted in a fair manner. By the way, the defendants say that their torture is continuing, and the conditions at Camp 7 at Guantanamo are aggravating the torture they endured in the black sites. Now, we claim we don't torture anymore, and the definition could be problematic here. But the bottom line is that we don't honor the fundamental legal and human rights of the people that we hold at Guantanamo, and that there are a couple of dozen who won't even get treated to the kangaroo court process. They're just going to be held indefinitely without charge or trial. Well, the Army has a new set of excuses for the raid on the Kunduz Hospital of Doctors Without Borders on October 3rd. And we know now that more than 30 people were killed in that attack. And it was more than one bombing raid. It was sustained, repeated attacks on the hospital compound. Well, now the military is saying, gosh, we're aware it was a functioning hospital, but we believed it was under Taliban control. Now, that excuse doesn't play under international law. Even if the Taliban controlled the hospital, it is a site that is out of bounds for military action. And the U.S. has now appointed another set of generals to investigate this. I think they're just going to investigate it to death and hope that people will forget about it. But the top commander, John Campbell, in Afghanistan has appointed someone from another command, Major General William B. Hickman, and two brigadier generals to investigate. And I have no confidence that we will hear the truth from a military investigation of the military. And meanwhile, another Doctors Without Borders medical facility has been bombed, this time in northern Yemen. It was bombed at least twice overnight by warplanes belonging to the military coalition led by Saudi Arabia. Well, come on, it was the Saudis. And they bombed several health facilities during the seven-month war, but the airstrikes appeared to be the first time that their warplanes had directly struck a clinic run by Doctors Without Borders, which supplied the coordinates of this location to the Saudis 6 months ago and has reconfirmed them every month. But the rules don't apply, and nobody tries to enforce them. And, of course, if you take them to the UN Human Rights Council, now chaired by Saudi Arabia, oh, you're going to get some real justice and honest investigation. Meanwhile, an unnamed Saudi prince has been busted at the airport in Beirut, attempting to smuggle 2 tons worth of amphetamines on a private jet. Now, we don't know which of the dozens of princes in the Saudi royal family got nabbed with the amphetamines. They grabbed 2 tons of Captagon pills, the brand name for a synthetic stimulant used to treat attention deficit disorders. It is a widely abused drug in Saudi Arabia, where all drugs are illegal, and the penalty for possession and use of drugs is death, often by public beheading. Will that apply to a Saudi prince? There's another one who is facing charges from a number of women in Los Angeles, charges of rape and sexual abuse. And these are our great friends, allies of the United States. We continue to defend and cozy up to the Saudis. And it's really embarrassing, often humiliating, in my opinion. Well, Friday night, Rachel Maddow got a big scoop. Hillary Rodham Clinton appeared on Rachel's show for a lengthy interview, and the first time the two of them have ever sat down together. And it was an interesting interview. One of the things that was unusual is that, of course, Rachel Maddow is one of the best-known lesbian media personalities in the country. And Hillary chose Rachel Maddow to try to rewrite history about the efforts back when Bill Clinton was president to block the aspirations of gays and lesbians with the so-called Defense of Marriage Act. It was passed in 1996, and Bill Clinton signed it. And on Friday night, Hillary said, well, you know, at the time, this was the least worst option available. that this is just a law and a law can be changed, but there was an effort to run a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage, and we just thought that this was the best way to avoid that. Well, it's pure bullshit. And to his credit, Bernie Sanders, who appeared on Rachel Maddow's Monday night show with a raspy voice from, I guess, he'd been shouting at a Verizon labor rally in New York yesterday. Anyway, he kind of flatly said, without a lot of anger or vitriol, that Hillary's wrong. That Bernie was there. Bernie was one of the few people in the House who voted for, who voted against the Defense of Marriage Act and for gay rights. And he told Maddow, he said this in Iowa on Saturday. Today, some are trying to rewrite history by saying they voted for one anti-gay law to stop something worse. That's not the case. There was a small minority opposed to discriminating against our gay brothers and sisters. Not everybody held that position in 1996. And other people, including supporters of Bill and Hillary Clinton, are backing Bernie Sanders up. Yes, Hillary's wrong. It didn't happen that way. And here's a quote from David Mixner, well-known LGBT activist. Hillary's version of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and DOMA is so wrong. The only defensive posture was for their personal politics. The LGBT community should never allow any politician to revise our noble and courageous history for political purposes. And news report, Bloomberg, says DOMA was poised to become law with or without Clinton's signature. It passed 85-14 in the Senate, 342-67 in the House. Margins easily big enough to override a presidential veto. The question to gay rights advocates was whether Clinton would stand on the right side of history and force Congress to override his veto, but to their dismay, he signed the bill. And yesterday, I mentioned that I was deeply offended by the racist comments of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, would-be presidential candidate, on the CBS program Face the Nation Sunday morning. And he amplified remarks that had been made on Friday by the FBI director, James Comey. And Comey wasn't as pointedly racist about it, but he essentially said that the Black Lives Matter movement and the use of video cameras to keep cops from beating people up and abusing their authority is leading to more crime. As if the solution is to allow cops to beat people up and break the law, because that keeps people in line. And Christie amped it up by blaming Obama and saying that Black Lives Matter is, group is essentially supporting killing the police. So today, in a pretty strong editorial, the New York Times joined me. Let me read a couple of pickups here. Video recordings of police officers battering or even murdering unarmed black citizens have validated longstanding complaints by African Americans and changed the way the country views the issue of police brutality. Cops who might once have felt free to arrest or assault black citizens for no cause and explain it away later have been put on notice that the truth could be revealed by a cell phone video posted on the internet. The Times continues, this kind of public scrutiny is all to the good, given the damage police brutality has done to the African American communities for generations and the corrosive effect on the broader society. Yet the peeling away of secrecy on these indisputably unconstitutional practices is now being challenged by politicians who want to soft pedal or even ignore police misconduct while attacking the people who expose it or raise their voices in protest against it. This trend is like something straight out of Orwell. Then they slam Chris Christie, calling him the increasingly desperate presidential candidate who is going nowhere fast. Took this posture on Sunday when he accused Obama of encouraging lawlessness and violence against police officers by acknowledging that the country needed to take both police brutality and the Black Lives Matter protest movement seriously. Then they say that James Comey, whose remarks were not as racially poisonous as Christie's, were no less incendiary. And I agree with that. The formulation implies that for police to do their jobs, they need to have free rein to be abusive. It also implies that the public would be safer if Americans with cell phones never started circulating videos of officers battering suspects in the first place. Well, As you know, I agree with the New York Times, or they agree with me. It doesn't matter the order. But we need to prevent this kind of blue wall pushback. We saw it after the Eric Garner killing, when that dude from Baltimore came up and coldly killed a police officer or two in New York. And then the sympathy for the police, their ploy of presenting themselves as victims of brutality, and how, you know, somehow this justifies their rampant, illegal, and unconstitutional abuse of suspects. It's incoherent, irrational, it's insulting, and we've got to deal with it. That's my news and comment for today. Thanks for listening, and feel free to share this with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.